morning.
It is.
Is this on?
It's on and off this morning. It's an honor to be with you this morning. And thank you, Nick, very much for those kind words. You know, anybody that has kids as they approach adulthood knows that one of your biggest worries is, who are they going to marry? Because you realize that that can make or break your children's lives. And it's great when you have a son-in-law who's not just a son-in-law, but has become a son. And we just really appreciate Nick a lot. And it's been an honor to be asked to speak to you all this morning. My wife and I have visited over the last 3 years several times. We've enjoyed worshiping with you. And again, it just is a real honor to be here this morning. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 46 and 47, pretty much the verses that Nick read. And so I'm going to be looking at the life of three different men in Genesis. Jeannie walked excitedly down the busy street. Her really good friends, Dr. and Mrs. Williams, had invited her over for dinner. And Jeannie knew that Mrs. Williams was a better cook than she, just about anybody else that she knew. Dr. Williams taught in the English department and was one of the most godly men that Jeannie had ever met. He had moved to Lebanon several years earlier as a tent maker, where he worked in the English department of the university, but his real goal was to be able to bring the gospel to those who desperately needed it there in the Middle East. Jeannie had served many years in the refugee camps in Jordan, but had recently been evacuated because of threats of war. She had to leave everything she owned and found herself in Beirut teaching at the university as well. The Williams had taken Jeannie under their wing when she moved to Beirut. They had helped her to heal from the many heart wounds and disappointments she had experienced in the refugee camps. And now she felt closer to them than she felt to her own parents. She trusted their godly wisdom and advice implicitly. If they said not to do something, Jeannie would probably not do it. But there was another reason that there was a spring in Jeannie's step as well tonight. About a year earlier, Jeannie had met Habib. He was a dashing, somewhat mysterious graduate student who lived in the apartment below her and her roommate. At her invitation, Habib had started hanging out with several of Jeannie's friends on the faculty. And although she knew better, Jeannie found herself strangely attracted to this young man who had grown up in a very strict Muslim country with a very strict Muslim family. Despite many late-night conversations, particularly with Dr. Williams and another professor, Bill Young, Habib continued to be reluctant about turning his back on his family and on the traditional religion of his country. And then the miraculous happened. Somehow, in the middle of the night, God had stepped in and the Holy Spirit worked a powerful, powerful thing in Habib's heart. And in the middle of the night, he went and found Bill Young and received Christ as his Savior. And 1 week later, he was off, away from Beirut, back in Afghanistan, taking the job in the government where he was promised. Jeannie and Habib had continued to write to each other, and Jeannie knew that this was the only man she wanted to marry. She had been recently able to travel Afghanistan, and he assured her that he was still saved, and they made plans to marry. And as she was walking down the street in Beirut, all these thoughts were swirling through her head. She knocked on the Williams' door. Mrs. Williams welcomed Jeannie into their small but cozy apartment, and she sat down to a delicious dinner. After dinner, Dr. Williams took Jeannie's hand like a loving father and looked at her and said, "Jeannie, there is something I have to talk to you about. You know that we love Habib as much as we love you. We think it's wonderful that he has professed faith in Christ. And we also know that you have fallen in love with him and are planning on marrying him. Jeannie, this is not a wise move. You do not know him well enough. You do not know that his faith is genuine. You do not understand his culture and his family. We beg you, please, please do not marry Habib. This is a huge mistake. You should not do this. Jeannie was stuck with a dilemma. Does she follow what seems like all the right signs, or does she listen to someone that she honors and respects very much? You know, probably as a Christian, one of the hardest things to really deal with on a daily basis is God's sovereignty. Is our life laid out for us and we have no choices? Or do we have choices, and how does God fit into those choices? I think a lot of times, a lot of us function sort of on a, I'll live my life, and God will step in when he needs to. But it's very rare that we actually come face to face with that sovereignty. And it has a major impact in our lives. And as we study today in these two chapters in Genesis, we're going to look at how God's sovereignty is playing out in the lives of these three J's, Jacob, Judah, and Joseph. Now, in order to do that, we kind of have to back up a little bit to get the background here. I don't know about you, but I kind of grew up in a tradition where there were all these Bible stories, and they all just kind of hung independently of each other. Oh, yeah, there's the story of Noah, and there's the story of Joseph, and there's the story of Daniel, and they're just all a bunch of stories. But that's not how the Bible is written. The Bible is written as one big story, and it starts in Genesis. And in Genesis 1, we see a God who is so powerful that all he has to do is speak and the world comes into being. And so we see the power of God's word and his power that he's got a plan for this creation that he has now created. And in the midst of that creation, the crowning glory is man. He's not just another animal. He is made in the image of God. And man was designed to co-reign with God on earth, taking care of the garden and having communion with God. And we see that in Genesis 1 and 2. But then in Genesis chapter 3, a new character is introduced, the serpent. And the serpent introduces the thought to the Adam and Eve, that God maybe doesn't know what he's talking about. Or if he does, there are certain things that God doesn't want you to know, because then you'll be more powerful than him. So the serpent, in a way, brings into question God's sovereignty. Does God have the right to tell Adam and Eve what to do? And in extension, does God have the right to tell us, this is how we live? Or do we have the right to do that? And in taking from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Adam and Eve said, they turned their back on God's sovereignty, and they said, we know what to do for our lives. We can handle our own lives. We can know what's good and evil. And we all know what the result of that was. It was a disaster. But in the midst of that disaster, in Genesis 3:15, God makes a promise. And he tells Adam and Eve, despite the fact that your lives are going to be miserable now by your own choice, because you have chosen to figure out what's good and evil. You know, if you think about it, why is it that humans don't have the right or the ability to determine good and evil? It's because we're not omniscient. We don't know all of the possibilities that may come about from our choices. So we just make choices in a vacuum, not knowing. God is sovereign. He knows all the what ifs, what could have beens, and what didn't happen based on everything that's going on. And he is in absolute control of all those things. But in the midst of the sorrow of Adam and Eve, God offers them a promise. He tells them that at some point, the seed of the woman, the son of the woman, is going to destroy the serpent that destroyed them. The serpent's going to bite his heel, but he's going to crush his head. And so throughout the entire Old Testament, we see this story building. It starts in Genesis way down here, and it just keeps building, looking for the serpent crusher. Who is this serpent crusher going to be? Who is going to be the person that is going to restore mankind back to the Garden of Eden? And the next major character that we see coming on the scene is Noah. And what do we know about Noah? He found grace in the eyes of the Lord because God showed favor on him. It was nothing that Noah did. And it looks like, well, maybe Noah is going to be the serpent crusher. Maybe Noah is going to restore Eden. And Noah comes out of the flood, just him and his family, and it's looking like that's exactly what's going to happen. But we find out Noah's just a man like anybody else. He's not the serpent crusher. And as we move through Genesis, we see this story kind of building and developing. Who's the serpent crusher going to be? Where is he coming from? What is this? What's going to happen? The next major figure on the scene is Abraham. And God makes a promise to Abraham. He says, in you, I'm going to give you a name. I'm going to give you a very large family and all the land and all the nations of the world are going to be blessed in you. And that's a great promise, except for one thing. Abraham has no children, and Abraham is, at that point of the promise, was 75 years old, and his wife was 65. Probably not going to happen naturally. But God makes this promise to Abraham. And so we see Abraham struggling with this promise and trying to figure out how is this going to be made real, this covenant that God has made through him. And as we see Abraham's offspring grow and develop, we see that it is only through faith in that Yahweh, God, is going to keep his promises, that God is in control, that they find favor in the sight of God. In the Abraham story, we find more of an emphasis on this possession of the land. Abraham wanders all over the land making altars. His son, Isaac, establishes the family, and Isaac's son, Jacob, really builds out that family with the 12 tribes. And then in the story of Joseph at the end of Genesis, we see God's bringing blessing the world to the front. But the thing is when you look over all of these patriarchs, there's one question that's looming. And it's kind of interesting because my dad called me. He was studying Genesis, and he said, I don't get it. I said, what? He said, I don't get why God is using these people. I mean, they're dead set on just ignoring what God has to say. And so and my dad had it right. The big question that kind of looms over the last part of Genesis is, how is God going to accomplish his purposes with such frail, sinful people? You know, how in the world are all the nations of the world going to be blessed when you have a family who's bent on destructing itself? How in the world is this ever going to happen? In Genesis 46 and 47, bring together these final three characters whose individual stories are not so much important as it is to the overall message that they teach. God is faithful to his promises. And our only hope today, as back then, lies in the fact that God not only uses his faithfulness, but even our sinful choices to bring about his sovereign plan. Now, the first J that we're going to talk about is Jacob, and this is in Genesis 46, 1 through 4. And God appears to Jacob and tells him, don't be afraid to go down into Egypt. Now, Jacob is characterized as someone who has faith. He has faith in God, but he really, really struggles with making that real in his everyday life. Jacob feels that he has to work out things on his own. As much as I dislike it, I really, really can sympathize with Jacob because of this whole thing of, like, I can make my life work. And we see this in Jacob. He's someone who is marked by manipulative schemes, always trying to get ahead, and that ends up really harming him. He is his whole life is marked, his story is marked by God having to do things in his life to get him to realize you can't control it. You are not in control of your life. I am in control of your life. And the other thing that Jacob doesn't seem to understand is the importance of the covenant. Jacob's not a very good father. And I say that in comparison to his grandfather, Abraham. In Genesis 18:9, God says, or Moses tells us that God thinks, "For I have chosen him," and he's referring to Abraham, "that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." God knew Abraham's heart. He knew that Abraham had a heart that would pass the covenant on to his children. And this was important for the keeping of the covenant and for the continuation of the covenant. It was a family covenant. It was a country that was eventually going to have this covenant. And so it had to be passed on through the family. And Jacob doesn't seem to understand that. He wasn't a very good father. He doesn't seem to pass on to his children, "You are really important in God's sight. For some reason, he has picked our family for this big thing to be a blessing to the people." He plays favorites. He's got wicked, wicked sons. He just is not the greatest father. But there is something positive about Jacob. Despite all the manipulative schemes, despite just not being a very good father, he does truly seek after God. At times, it's in times of distress, but he does seek God. And we see in four different instances throughout Genesis, Jacob is building an altar and finding out something about God. In Genesis 28, God reveals himself as Yahweh, "I am." In Genesis 31, Jacob builds another altar. God reveals himself as El Bethel, the one whose supplies or house. In chapter 35, El Shaddai, the provider God. And here in chapter 46, God tells Jacob, he says, "I am God, the God of your father." And in claiming to be, or in stating that he was the God of your father, he's bringing that whole covenant back in. And he's telling Jacob, "Don't be afraid to go down into Egypt. I have a plan that's going on here. Don't be afraid. I am the God of your father. I am the God of the covenant. This is something you need to do. You need to go down into Egypt." And Jacob acts on that and packs up the family from Canaan and moves them down to Egypt. We then run into the second Jay, who's really kind of an interesting character. His name is Judah. And in Genesis 46:28, he says, "He sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him in Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen." Now, who is this Judah guy? Judah was the fourth son of Jacob. If you remember the Old Testament, fourth sons didn't have a whole lot of say in anything. The first son was the most important. He would become the leader of the family. He would get the greatest inheritance. And the other sons would kind of have to fit in underneath that. But here we see that Jacob is sending the fourth son to be the spokesman for the family. So who is Judah? Why is all of a sudden he become the spokesman? In Judah, we see someone who is evolving and growing. I wouldn't say that he's growing spiritually, because in my look at this, Judah really has no spiritual insight whatsoever. He just never seems to show any. When we first meet Judah, it's in chapter 37, and he's the one that's leading the charge to kill Joseph. When Joseph is out looking for them, Judah's the one that says, "You know what, let's get rid of him. And it will save us all a problem." So Judah's the one that's leading that charge. In chapter 38, we have a really bizarre story about Judah and how he refused. His sons were wicked. They died. And in the culture of the time, the next son would be given to the widow in order to raise up a son that would keep the name in that family. And Judah refused to do that. And through a variety of different mechanisms, his daughter-in-law managed to have a son that would carry on the family name. And she, through acting as a prostitute, is said to be more righteous than Judah, because Judah just despised the fact that he was supposed to raise up a son in his name. So he doesn't seem to have any concern about the family line. He doesn't understand how important spiritually this whole thing is. However, he does develop as a leader, and we see this coming out here in chapter 46. In 43, remember, Joseph is down in Egypt, and he is now over all of Egypt. He's second to Pharaoh. The 12 sons of Israel, or Jacob, come to get food. Joseph recognizes them. They don't recognize him. Joseph tells them, I'm going to give you food, but when you come back, you have to bring Benjamin back. And Benjamin was Joseph's full brother. Benjamin had replaced Joseph as Jacob's favored son. And all of the other sons knew that if they had to bring Benjamin back, it would kill their father, because he didn't want to run the risk of losing another son, his favorite son. So when the food runs out, Judah is the one that comes to Jacob and says, we have to take Benjamin with us. We can't go by ourselves. And Jacob says, no, we'll starve. And Judah is saying, look, you can take my life if Benjamin doesn't come back. And Jacob says, okay, everybody's going to starve anyhow. Go ahead and go. But make sure he comes back. Well, they get down there. Joseph is still trying to see, are they repentant? He puts his silver drinking vessel in Benjamin's grain sack. Joseph's servants find this, and they basically say, we're keeping Benjamin. You can't take him back. Who do you think it is that comes to the rescue of Benjamin? It's Judah. And Judah tells Joseph, you can't do this. You will break my father's heart. This is his favored son. He's already lost one son that was his favorite. This is his favorite son. You will break my father's heart. And we see a complete change in Judah. The one that wanted to kill Joseph is now greatly concerned about his father and about this favored son. And the interesting thing is that it was Judah's response that broke Joseph's heart so that Joseph reveals himself to Judah. Joseph saw in Judah, this man has changed. And now I'm going to show them who I am. And that leads up to Jacob bringing the whole family down into Egypt. So Judah, then, we see here in this passage, that is sent ahead to be the spokesman for the family. So in Judah, we see someone who, although makes a lot of mistakes, and is quite frankly sinful, and doesn't have any interest in living a spiritual life, God is still using him. At the end of his life, when Jacob is giving the blessing to his 12 sons, Judah gets the best blessing, the longest blessing. In other words, Judah is being treated as the oldest. And Jacob tells Judah, you are going to be the leader. From your tribe, a king will arise. And Jacob, in his blessing to Judah, makes an allusion to the fact that not only will a king rise from the tribe of Judah, but the serpent crusher is going to come from the tribe of Judah. So in God's grand sovereign plan, he takes someone who shows absolutely no interest in anything spiritual and changes it around so that he can use that person to be a great, 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 great grandfather of the serpent crusher. And the third J that we're going to talk about here is Joseph. In chapter 46, 29 through 31, it says, Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father in Goshen. He presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. Israel said to Joseph, now let me die since I've seen your face and I know that you are alive. If we were just reading the Bible for the first time, we might think that Joseph is the serpent crusher. He's one of two characters in the Old Testament that nothing negative is said about him. Nothing negative. And he also has some characteristics that seem to be serpent crusherish. He has dominion over the land. He's able, under his administration, the land produces a lot of grain. He's able to protect people when the land is not producing. So he has this dominion. And Joseph really looks like he's going to be the serpent crusher. So it becomes quite surprising that Jacob gives the main blessing to Judah and rather than Joseph. But if Jacob is portrayed as being seeking God but trying to do it on his own, Judah is portrayed as not having a whole lot of spiritual interest. Joseph is portrayed as trusting in God. You know, Yahweh was with Joseph, and that was the reason for his success. Joseph does not need to be reformed, at least in the story that we know. There's nothing that indicates that Joseph is like his father Jacob that has to go through a bunch of trials in order to bring him along and break his will. Joseph goes through everything that he goes through because that was God's will for his life. God needed him in Egypt. So God worked through his life, through the suffering. Yes, but God used all of that to get Joseph in place to bring the big picture together. And it's important to notice, you know, Joseph is mentioned another place as well. And that's in Hebrews chapter 11. And in 22, the author of Hebrews says, "By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones." You know, you would think, given the airtime that Joseph is given in Genesis, he's given a lot. Probably Abraham is the only other character in Genesis that has more words written about him than Joseph. You would think that the thing that the writer of Hebrews would mark as being the thing that Joseph showed faith in was that he endured through all of those sufferings, he still kept his eyes on God. That's what I would say. But the writer of Hebrews, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, that's not what he says. He says Joseph shows faith because he knew that the Israelites would eventually go back to Canaan and to take his bones with them. Joseph understood the covenant. He knew that the covenant was tied up in the family and it was tied up back in the land. And no matter what they were doing in Egypt at this point, at some time they were going back to the land. And I think that gives us some insight into what Joseph's role in this whole thing is. Joseph's role is to be the savior of the family. He makes arrangements for his family to live in Egypt. He understands what they need to say to the Egyptians. And he understands how they should live in Egypt. He saves them from starvation. And he puts them in good graces with Egypt. And when they're in Egypt, Israel is going to mature as a nation. Now that's important, because that was predicted. Once again, we got to go back to Abraham. In Genesis 15:13, God says to Abraham, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. Joseph is the means by which God is bringing about this prophecy that he made to Abraham. And that's important, because think about who was Genesis written to. I don't think we think about that very often. Genesis was written by Moses, probably during the 40 years of wandering. And what was the purpose of Genesis? To give the new nation their history. This is where you come from. And you've got someone that has been a slave, who has come through the Red Sea, has seen God work miraculously, may or may not have believed that God could take care of them. And Moses writes this story. He says, look, the reason that you were in Egypt was because this is part of God's plan. God told Abraham this was going to happen. God used Joseph to get you there, and you are the ones that are now coming back. That land is yours. The covenant is yours. God is sovereign. God will take care of us. And that's what Moses is saying here. And that's the function that Joseph is serving. But Joseph serves another function as well. Joseph serves the function of the covenant of blessing the world. Think about it. Joseph was probably one of two of the most powerful Jews that have ever lived. I personally think Daniel was more powerful, but Joseph was very, very powerful. And it is through Joseph that people are able to live through this famine. Joseph's administration of the grain is what allows other people to live. Through Joseph, the world is blessed. And when you look at the story, sometimes you may think, well, that's because Pharaoh made Joseph who he was. No. If you read the story of Joseph, God took Joseph to Egypt. God gave Joseph the ability to interpret dreams. God got Joseph back into prison. God put the baker and the butler in prison. God pulled Joseph out of prison. God brought the years of plenty and the years of famine. God made Joseph who he was. Why? Because Israel had to come down into Egypt in order to fulfill the grand scheme of things. This whole thing is being orchestrated. Manipulated is not the right word. It's being orchestrated so that God's promise will come to pass. That God's sovereignty is the thing that is saving all of these people. And there's an interesting scene in Genesis chapter 47 where Joseph brought Jacob, his father, and stood him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many are the days of your life?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days and the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attended to the days of the years of the lives of my fathers and the days of their sojourning." And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now, here you have Pharaoh, who is the most powerful person in the world at that time. Okay? And coming before him is this decrepit 120-something, 130-year-old person, shepherd, who's lived all of his life manipulating, scheming, trying to get what he wants. Most powerful man in the world, Jacob. Who do you think should be blessing whom? You would expect that Pharaoh, who had all the power, would be blessing Jacob. But that's not what we see. We see that Jacob is blessing Pharaoh. And it's another clue back to that covenant. The world will be blessed through the offspring of Abraham. The world is going to be blessed by the serpent crusher. You may have power, you may have fame, you may have all of this, but it is the world who is going to be blessed through Israel. Israel blesses the world. And how does Israel eventually do that? Because the serpent crusher eventually does come. And the serpent crusher is born in a little town of Bethlehem, the Son of God. He grows up and he starts a ministry that people do not like. And he shows people who God is. Because the serpent crusher, Jesus, is God. And that's the incredible thing about the whole story. It's not just that God orchestrates all this in his sovereignty to put somebody in that position of being serpent crusher. No. From the very beginning, God is orchestrating all this so that he himself can come and be the serpent crusher, die on the cross, pay the penalty for our sins, so that we can be restored to Eden. That's what this is all about. It's not about Jacob, Judah, and Joseph. It's not about you and me. It's about Christ. And the whole Old Testament is building up to the cross. And the whole New Testament comes out of the cross. And at the center of all of this is the cross of Christ. The serpent crusher. The one who, though his heel was bruised by the serpent, crushed his head, and someday Satan will be defeated and in hell. And why? So that we, as humans, can be restored back to what we were supposed to be in the Garden of Eden. So, that's the story. What are some take-home messages that we can take from this about the sovereignty of God in our own lives? I mean, it's great to see the big picture, and I get really excited about telling that story. And it's important in our own lives because Christ is so important in our own lives, but how can we apply the sovereignty of God in everyday circumstances? And the first thing I want to point out is that what we consider lucky or coincidental is actually God working his will. In the story of Joseph, he is sent to find his brothers. His brothers aren't where they are supposed to be. Joseph, in the way Moses writes it, is Joseph here, overhears, happens to hear someone saying that a group of shepherds took their sheep and went north about 14 miles. That coincidence? I don't know. I don't think it is. Because had Joseph not been just overheard this man, he would have gone back and he would have avoided a very long, painful sojourn in Egypt. But God needed him in Egypt. He hears this. It's God's will working out. There is no such thing as luck. There is no such thing as a coincidence in the Christian's life. The Bible knows only of providence. And throughout this whole story, you should see God working behind the scenes. This is God working this out to bring it to a point where Israel will go down into Egypt. And Joseph realizes this. And in chapter 50, when his brothers are worried about Joseph is going to retaliate, what does he say to them? God intended all of this for good. I don't hold anything against you. Everything that I have been through, including prison, being sold as a slave, all of that, God was using that for good. I'm not going to hold that against you. So there is no such thing as coincidence or luck when you believe in sovereignty. The second thing is what appears to be the hand of man is actually God's providence. As I said before, Joseph appears to be Pharaoh's man. But you can tell that that's not what the writer is saying. Joseph is God's man. And this is God working out in Joseph's life everything that needs to happen in order to bring about his will. And even Pharaoh himself is serving as an instrument that God is using to work out his sovereignty in the world. Third thing is, we learned this from Judah, God's sovereignty and blessing can be found in what appear to be the worst crimes and the most disastrous circumstances. I don't know how this works. God does not approve of our sin. I know that. But somehow, because he is sovereign, because he is God, he can use that sin to bring about incredible things. Judah, for example. God uses Judah's rejection of anything spiritual, turns it around, and makes him the leading family in Israel. The serpent crusher comes from the tribe of Judah. Even more, how can God used the death of his son on the cross, the worst crime in history, to bring about ultimate good. You know, heard a story of two men were talking to each other, and one man says to the other one, "Do you know why Satan is so angry all the time? Because whenever he works a clever bit of mischief, God uses it to serve his own righteous purposes." The other man says, "So God uses wicked people as his tools?" The first man says, "Well, God gives us the freedom to do great evil if we choose. Then he uses his own freedom to create goodness out of that evil. For that is what he chooses." The other man says, "So in the long run, God always wins." And the first man says, "Yes, God always wins. In the short run, though, it can be very uncomfortable." And that brings me to my last point, is that when dealing with sovereignty, we know the end of Joseph's story, but Joseph didn't know the end of his story. And it's interesting when you run into that sovereignty. It's back to my original story about Jeannie and Habib. What should Jeannie do? Does she listen to a person that she respects? Or does she look at what looks like God working in her life and providing a husband? I can tell you what she did because I'm here. Jeannie is my mother, Habib is my father. I heard this story a couple years ago. I don't know how I missed it growing up, but I heard it a couple years ago. And it just struck me with, if my mom would have listened to this guy, who I've met is one of the most godly people I have ever met, I wouldn't be here. But she didn't listen to him. And I'm here. And what does that mean for my life? What is God doing in my life? What is God doing in my kids' life? When you run into that sovereignty and you're like, whoa, it makes you think. And we go back to Joseph. He didn't know what the end was. I don't know if he knew the promise that God had made to Abraham. But he knew that God was sovereign. He knew that he could trust God. And our stories, we don't know the end of them either. You may be, I don't know what you're facing today. You don't know what I'm facing. But God is sovereign. And even more importantly, God is love. And he loves to work, to bring about everything in our lives for good. It's what Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8. We may not like it. It may be uncomfortable, but God is bringing that about in our lives for good. I remember a song that I heard when I was a lot younger, and part of the chorus went something like, "I'm growing, but I don't like it. I'm growing and it hurts. I'm tired, but I know you love me. I guess I've got a lot to learn." And it's just the idea of this life stinks. But God is sovereign. God knows what you're going through. God knows what you're facing, the problems, the decisions, the not knowing what's going to happen next. He knows all those things. And just like the grand story of the serpent crusher, if you are a believer, you are part of that story. And God cares about the minute details, just like he cared about Joseph. He needed Joseph in Egypt for his will to come about. And in the end, that was the best thing for Joseph. But don't get me wrong here. I'm not Joel Osteen preaching some sort of prosperity gospel here. Just because God is bringing you through suffering does not mean that the end is going to be always good. You know, it's interesting. You know, most of us know the story of Jim Elliot, the missionary who was martyred in the jungles of Ecuador. And, you know, a lot of good came out of that. But what if Jim Elliot had not been martyred? What if Jim Elliot had spent his entire life laboring in the jungles of Ecuador, trying to bring the gospel to a group of Ecuadorians who are essentially killing each other off? They would have gone extinct in the next probably 10 years because of their warlike habits. And what if we had never heard of Jim Elliot or Elizabeth Elliot or Nate Saint or any of the other people involved in that story? Would their working in the jungles of Ecuador have been any less significant? No. It would have been the same. In God's sovereignty, he chose to use that situation. He chose to make these men martyrs in order to bring about a bigger story. But that doesn't make their story more important. And we live our lives. Sometimes it feels like it's in obscurity. No one notices. No one knows what we're going through. But God does. And it's the journey is more important than the end. Because the journey is what God uses to mold us. And our service to God is not just compromised, because it's not just comprised of the end result. Our service to God, bringing him glory, is through day to day being faithful. Just like Joseph. Whether he was in prison or whether he was on the throne. So, in Genesis 46 through 47, we see the intersection of God's sovereign work in the lives of three J's: Jacob, Judah, and Joseph. In Jacob, we see God directing someone who just can't get over trying to control life on his own. How many of us are there? In Judah, we see God elevating someone despite his sinful behavior and lack of spiritual insight. And in Joseph, we see God using a faithful servant's life through pain and suffering to bring about his will. In each one of these stories, God is committed to keeping his promises, no matter what the actions of the men were. In each of the three J's, we see that our only hope lies in God's unlimited sovereignty, and that we can trust him every day, even now, to faithfully work out that plan in our lives to bring him glory.